White Rocket Entertainment.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Avengers Assemble 006, The Korvac Saga.
It's the Avengers Assemble podcast from the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net. Now, here's your host, Van Allen Plexico.
Hello, and welcome to the Avengers Assemble podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net in association with the Earth Station One Network. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I'm joined this episode by David Wright. Welcome back aboard, David.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And, David, how would you describe what you do normally? You're a videographer as well as a longtime comics fan. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I'm a video producer. I've worked in advertising and documentaries. I now head up the television department for Fort Benning's public affairs office. So I'm doing work for the Department of Defense there, the Army installation in Georgia.
So does Henry Peter Gyrick come by every now and then and try to revoke your clearance and everything?
Well, let's just say I'm familiar with the personality type.
Very good. Well, we're going to encounter Henry Peter Gyrick and a few other very interesting side characters along the way today, because we are going to be talking about one of the I don't know if anybody, and we have quite a few friends who are lifelong big Avengers fans between you and me, and I don't know of anybody that considers it their absolute favorite or the absolute greatest. But I think, tell me if I'm wrong, I think most Avengers fans, certainly the older ones that read it at the time or read it shortly thereafter, most Avengers fans consider it one of their favorites and probably one of the greatest storylines in Avengers history. How does that sound to you?
That sounds right. I mean, clearly there are a handful of all-time great Avenger stories, and this one is a constant inclusion on that list. I don't know anybody that would leave it out. It's right. Definitely one of the crown jewels in the history of Avengers comics. And do I know anybody that actually has it ranked the top number one? I don't know. Maybe I do. I guess maybe you would be the most likely candidate. Notwithstanding the annual, the two-part annual story with Thanos. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely, for folks that know their Avengers history, Korvac's saga is always near the top of the list. I mean, it just is. It's kind of a no-brainer. It's definitely one of the all-time great. That also, it's just another example of putting the Avengers at the forefront of the Marvel Universe during the time this was published in 78, late 77 into 78.
Yeah, I was rereading it this morning, and I was thinking how when I read this story the first time, I had never heard of Battlestar Galactica. I had probably just seen Star Wars months earlier, if not weeks earlier, and had not yet heard about Battlestar Galactica. So that's the time frame we're talking about, late 77, early 78, mm-hmm. Middle of the Carter administration and so forth. I was thinking he even showed up in this series, but it's actually Nick Fury that contacts him. There is a story somewhere in this run where Jimmy Carter is on the phone to the Avengers or something. It struck me as funny when I was a kid. But
I'll say this. You know, just kind of before we start drilling down, just big picture on the whole saga is perhaps one reason that it's not necessarily at the number one spot on anybody's list. And maybe it is. Maybe we can hear from some folks. But it's actually not let me see if I'm putting this right. I was going to say it's not as cosmic as your recollection might first tell you that it is. Sure, Korvac has cosmic power. I get that. And sure, we start off in outer space, the Guardians of the Galaxy, and all this kind of stuff. But it ends up being a fairly, ironically small scope, when they're on a bus going into the suburbs and knocking on the front door, and sitting around the living room is where it all climaxes. Yeah. So it's not, it doesn't, you know what I mean? It's, yeah. it kind of inverts those expectations a little bit, so it doesn't stay at that grand space opera scale for very long.
That's true. And some of the actual more cosmic stuff that happens in it really turns out to be the Collector instead of Korvac.
Instead of Korvac, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of the whole thing about the characters disappearing, which we'll get to. But there are two things I want to mention before we get into it, too. One is that as great as the Korvac story itself is, this roughly, let me see, let's tell people when it runs. It starts in 167, right after the Super Nefaria issues we talked about on our last conversation back a few episodes ago. So it starts in 167 and it runs through 177, which is, I guess, 11 issues. But then one of them is a fill-in issue. So it's really a 10-issue long story. And in some of those issues, the Korvac part of it is really the B or C plot while other things are happening. And so it actually, as big as it is, this 10-issue run actually includes one of the greatest Ultron stories over a two-issue run in the middle of it.
Yeah, it spans 10 or 11 issues, but it's not the sole focus of every issue. They'll leave it and then come back and revisit it. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, you're spinning either side stories or concurrent stories that are awesome in their own right. That's definitely true. And Bob Harris would later do kind of a similar structure when he was doing the Proctor and the Gatherer stuff. He started off with that story, then he'd leave it, go do Galactic Storm or Blood Ties, or they visit Archon's planet for a couple of issues, and then he keeps coming back to the Gatherer story, which ended up taking 2 or 3 years, but not every issue was about it. He would leave it to the side and tell other things. So I'm infamously more fond of that era than most people, but I'm not trying to compare it favorably to Korvac Saga, because Korvac Saga is definitely near the top of my list, but similar pattern. He's following the similar pattern that Shooter set here with these issues. Yeah. And I think that's something to keep in mind with all the way up through with Thomas Englehart and Shooter. Those were the years, and of course that's a large number of years, but they set the template, the foundation of how to tell Avengers stories, and we're still seeing that being defined right here with these issues. These are still kind of defining and pioneering in that way.
Yeah. And another thing I find interesting about it, now you got to tell me because you're more acquainted with it than I am, when Bob Harris later did the Proctor and Gatherer series years later, were the covers labeled like part 5 of the Proctor and the Gatherer saga, or was it just Avengers issues and it was just going on inside there along with other stuff?
No, it wasn't numbered. It wasn't like part X of so-and-so. It wasn't like that.
Yeah.
Toward the end, they would probably say the grand finale of the Gatherer saga or something like that as a cover blurb. Okay. But the only things that got like subset of numbers at the top were the chapters of Galactic Storm and chapters of Blood Ties, which were crossovers that are happening concurrent within that run.
Well, that's what I was wondering, because, I don't know if, younger fans today realize this, but up through the 70s even, if a big storyline was unfolding over multiple issues, you got no indication of it on the cover. Every cover just sold that one unique comic book, and I imagine because they thought they wanted people just to pick it up and not think they couldn't pick it up because it was part 7 of some series, or something. And so there's never any trade dress that says Korvac Saga Part 4 or anything like that. These were just issues of the Avengers coming out like episodes of a TV show, and you really didn't know what was going to happen in that particular episode until you opened up the cover, And so, like we were saying, some issues didn't even really touch much on Korvac, and then it would come back after an issue or two. And that, when we get into it, we're going to go into more detail, but that Ultron two-part story, which is really the second half of the 161-162 Ultron story, right, that they kind of left hanging. Where do you rate that one in terms of Avengers stories and Avengers Ultron stories?
You're talking about the 171.
Yeah.
Let's see, that's the stuff with Jocasta and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
I I put it up there. I mean, mm-hmm. you're coming right on the tales of I'm drawing a blank. This 162 and all that stuff that
was the Bride of Ultron.
Yeah, the Bride of Ultron. To me, it just goes right with it. It's yeah. It's a bookend to it. All of that is essential Ultron reading. I mean, mm-hmm. and this was an important follow up to it, important wrap up to it.
Yeah,
I mean, if you like the one, you got to like the other, and you're going to want the other.
Yeah, yeah, and the thing too, I guess the same artist too. You had Shooter and Perez. Perez was doing the art again, which is so great. The thing that I, you know, when I read those four issues as a kid, obviously 162 was the first one I ever read, and I had to go back and find 161 years later, which made an indelible mark on me and made me a lifetime Avengers fan. But then I remember when 170 and 171 came out, how excited I was that we were going to go back and deal with Ultron again, and how much I loved how those issues played out. But, you know, reading them again this morning, what blew my mind about it may be that back then, think about this, because you will totally know what I mean by this, David. Back then, when we were kids reading these, you'd spend 30 or 40 minutes just on the first read-through, studying everything, reading all the words, saying it in your head, studying the art. I mean, it was like you're watching an hour-long TV show reading one of these comics.
Absolutely.
And so reading them back through this morning at the speed I read things at nowadays, I was astonished at how quickly the second Ultron story in this particular set of issues was over. Right? I mean, in 170 they set it up, but you don't even see Ultron. And in 171 they reintroduce Ultron, have the entire conflict, and it's over all in like 20 pages.
Yeah, and you know what I would say to that? That it speaks to the difference in storytelling aesthetic, I guess, between 1978 and today.
Yeah.
I think you got a lot more for your money mm-hmm. back then, just in terms of number of panels and number of words per page. You were able to get more story into an issue. And it also kind of speaks to the pacing that Shooter, you know, was going for. He had a lot of big stories he was trying to tell, and he just couldn't tell them fast enough, I guess. But yeah, as you look at those issues – yeah, it's over quickly in the sense that it's two issues and really Ultron's only in one of them. Mm-hmm. But it's also George Perez, so you're getting a lot of panels per page, and I don't think you're really getting shorted on much story there. Now, if I can touch back on a couple other things you've mentioned, mm-hmm. you got really excited when these showed up because you had the other issues. Mm-hmm. So there's no trade dress, you know, and there's no there's the stuff you were talking about where this was in the era before direct market stores, and it was all driven by the newsstand. So Marvel's not assuming that someone's getting every issue. You know, they have to like play to that monthly casual reader. Right. But when you do get this kind of connect as a fan, it was something that was rewarding for fans. You had an older issue, you knew what they were talking about. That excited you. That made you feel like you were kind of on the inside track. You knew enough about what they were talking about to get it. That maybe other readers weren't getting, mm-hmm. and that's rewarding for fans. It gets us excited, makes us want to buy all the issues, so we know everything they're talking about.
Absolutely.
And I think that's important also when you realize this is still pre-direct market store era,
mm-hmm.
which is exactly what you're talking about. They wouldn't put any trade dress for this story on the cover. They're just putting on the newsstand and hoping people buy it that month. But that also speaks to maybe the risk or the groundbreaking that Shooter was undertaking with telling a story this way. Now, it wasn't the first time Marvel had done it. It wasn't the first time the Avengers had done it, or this Shooter had done it. But perhaps this is his longest running one, his longest spanning one. And to do it in that era of just strictly newsstand distribution is, you know, I mean, that wasn't without risk at the time it was happening.
Absolutely. Interesting, too, and it's such a big cast that they're working with, too, you know, which is addressed in the issues that follow after this, where they have to pare the team down, but not like the Guardians of the Galaxy were going to stay around anyway. I never understood that. But anyway, I was looking at the credits as I read through the whole thing again this morning, and I was fascinated that, you know, we already knew that David Michelinie did the scripts for several of the later issues of this storyline, because we had him, if you don't know, we had him on the show for two episodes a few months ago, and he talked about this and other things, and I knew that. But what I was startled to see, and I had totally missed before, is that Bill Mantlo wrote one of the issues. It was 174 with Hawkeye against the Collector.
Really? He scripted that?
Bill Mantlo, yeah. And did a great job. That's one of the best Avengers issues ever.
Yeah.
It's all about action.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Hawkeye versus the Collector. I mean, that's all-time classic right there.
Absolutely.
That's one of Hawkeye's career highlights.
Absolutely. Well, let's look at them a little bit through.
Okay. You want to get an overview, basically, big picture of what happened in the whole saga? Or you just want to dig into issue by issue here?
Yeah, well, definitely we want to do the look at the overall thing. The idea of this story, right, is that Jim Shooter was really hitting his stride now. He had just done basically Graviton, the first half of the Ultron saga, and the Super Nefaria. And so with 167, which, by the way, I believe this was one of the first issues I got through subscription. Because after I started reading it with 162 and 163, I subscribed, and I think I got 164, 65, 66, 67. Yeah, I think this is one of the early ones I got through subscription. I remember when I was a kid, by the way, I was very disappointed at the start of this story, because not a lot happens in 167. But yeah, the overview is that the Guardians of the Galaxy come back to the 20th century, to 1978, to guard Vance Astrovik, because they think that one of their enemies, Michael Korvac, is going to come back in time to kill him. And Michael Korvac was the Machine Man at the time. He was a guy that was, his upper half was human, and his bottom half was like a box, a machine box. And this continues a story out of a Thor annual, I believe, right? And so this is the classic Guardians of the Galaxy. It's the first time I'd ever encountered them, by the way.
Me too.
The Starhawk, Martin X, Yondu, Nikki, Charlie, and Vance Astrovik. The sort of futuristic sci-fi Guardians as opposed to the Dan Abnett Guardians from the movie.
Right.
So let me throw out a couple of things there and you fill in anything that I'm leaving out. So the Avengers and the Guardians hook up, and while a bunch of stuff is going on, you slowly realize through C plot and D plot developments over the first few issues that there's this big blonde headed guy who has very power, you know, very great cosmic power, and he is essentially what has become of Korvac. He's turned into sort of a living god, like a Galactus being in human size.
Well, he did. He actually basically got inside Galactus's spaceship and basically hacked it and got all the, and basically got power cosmic.
Mm-hmm.
And with this infinite power, turned himself into a regular dude in tennis shorts and lived in a suburban neighborhood.
Yep.
And you know, Starhawk, through the course of these issues, Starhawk discovers him.
Yeah.
And Korvac destroys him.
Utterly
and then
destroys him.
And then recreates him, mm-hmm. but minus the ability to ever perceive Korvac.
Which sets up one of the greatest moments in the whole series later on.
Yeah. And so the in the meantime, well, I guess I don't know whether you want to do the whole overview now or just get kind of into it with each issue, but
we'll go through issue by issue, but I just say the setup is the Avengers are trying to help the Guardians find Korvac, and at the same time somebody starts kidnapping Avengers, making them disappear, like teleporting them away, and we don't know if the two are connected at all or what's going on. So the Avengers are looking for somebody they just call the enemy, who's teleporting their members away one by one, while the Guardians are looking for Korvac, and of course they don't turn out to be the same person. It's the Collector that's teleporting Avengers away, but he's doing it because of Korvac. So it is all related. And there are several I wanted to mention a couple of subplots that run through these issues that I think are really neat. One of them is this really brings the Iron Man versus Captain America feud to a head.
Yes.
Because in the first two or three issues of this part, 167, 168, around 170, 171, through the first part of this, Captain America is just a total jerk. He has had enough of Iron Man. He doesn't know Iron Man is Tony Stark, right? He respects Tony Stark. Tony Stark's his friend. He thinks Iron Man is just some hired lackey mercenary. And so if Iron Man is not doing the job up to Cap's standards, Cap has no problem whatsoever calling him out, because Cap just thinks, look, you know, your only job in life is to be a bodyguard to Tony Stark and then lead the Avengers because you're the current chairman. And if you're not doing a good job leading the Avengers, you need to step down and get out of the way because you're just some cheap mercenary anyway. And so they about come to blows two or three times in the first several issues of this series. And Cap never will let him tell. Tony finally decides he needs to tell Cap the deal, right? Look, I'm Tony Stark. And he says, look, Cap, I should have told you this long ago, but... And Cap says, keep your secrets. He keeps calling him Tin Man, which really makes me want to punch Cap in the face, honestly. He keeps calling him Tin Man. He's like, keep your secrets. But they make up. They kind of kiss and make up when Iron Man says, you're right, I haven't been doing as good a job as I could. And if you want to take over, then I'll step out of the way. And Steve is like, no, I've been bad about it, you know, whatever. And they kind of make up. But still, every time he calls Iron Man Tin Man, I really do just want to punch him in the face.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if this is the first, like, real personality conflict we ever see between Steve and Tony. Certainly, that got developed, you know, since then and certainly in recent years. But this is, like, the earliest instance of it that I can recall. So it's and maybe there was a little bit of it in the Bride of Ultron story when you know, Iron Man got Shikasta, you know, in a headlock with a blaster pointed at her temple.
Yeah.
I can't remember what Cap's reaction was to that right off the top of my head. And I know there was some...
He was in a coma, wasn't he? Or was he awake by then?
I don't even remember. I have to go back and look at it.
I think he was still in a coma. I don't think he was there in that battle.
Okay. I know, you know, Mickley picks up on it in the Armor Wars a little bit, and then... But I wonder if this is truly like the first hint we see of like an opportunity to kind of have some interpersonal conflict and drama between Cap and Iron Man, because it's the first I can think of.
Yeah, and like I say, it's mainly just because Cap has a certain standard of behavior and performance, and I understand that. But he's just such a snot about it to Tony the whole way through, and he just treats him like he's, you know, like he's a private and Cap's the major stomping around. So it kind of irked me, but they do kind of settle down. The other kind of plot thread that does not directly relate to Korvac or Ultron, either one at all, but is very important here, as we were touching on a minute ago, is this is the beginning of Henry Peter Gyrick. He's an agent of the National Security Council, which basically means he works for the president and the National Security Advisor and all that. And he's there because he feels like the Avengers have done a bad job of keeping the mansion secure and keeping all their databases and contacts to the U.S. government secure. And so he finally just has enough. I believe Hawkeye comes in and catches him and doesn't know who he is and ties him up. And yep. that pushes him over the edge. And so he revokes all their top secret, all their A1 clearance, all their priority stuff. They can't even fly the Quinjets. They can't use their communicators. And, of course, this happens right in the middle of the Ultron and Korvac things going down, which are like the two of the greatest villains they've ever faced. So they are basically hamstrung, you know, fighting two of their biggest enemies ever. So...
Yeah, and that's good stuff. And Mickley picks that up with Gyrick, you know, and does more with him too. Kind of always portrayed as a major jerk and a thorn in their side, kind of just government bureaucracy getting in the way of the Avengers. So he's one of those fun supporting characters that everybody loves to hate.
Exactly. And you really do hate him. Okay, so kind of blow through the story a little bit. In 167... The the Avengers encounter the Guardians of the Galaxy for the first time in this story because they've come back to 1978 because they think Korvac's going to try to assassinate Vance before he's old enough to form the Guardians of the Galaxy, thus preventing his enemies from ever happening, you know, from ever being. And there's some funny stuff where the Guardians don't know the Avengers. They know him in general, but they don't recognize the Beast, for example. And so Charlie 27 grabs the Beast and thinks he's a blue space monkey, which is pretty funny. But anyway, by the time that issue is over, they're cooperating with each other, but we also know that there's a bigger enemy out there. And we also get Karina. We haven't really talked about Karina, and she's going to be important later, so we got to mention her. This is the Collector's daughter, though we don't know that for a while. And the Collector has sensed that Korvac exists, because he's a elder being, you know, like the Grandmaster. And so he sends his daughter Karina to spy on Korvac, but instead she falls in love with him and goes over to his side.
Yeah, so after Korvac gets powered up, Collector realizes that he's now a person in the universe that can be a threat to the elders. So Karina's not only sent there as a spy, but also as a weapon, I mean, to kind of take him out if she needs to. Unfortunately, you know, love gets in the way, I guess.
Yeah.
I mentioned this when we were talking about the other set of issues in our previous episode, but it was in this issue of 167 that we do finally get our first definitive establishing shot of Avengers Mansion and what it actually looks like.
Yes. Just a small one on top of the page, right?
Yep. That's the first time ever. It's 167 issues into the series, and we finally get to see what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was, I have to say this, somewhere in the first 10 issues, it seems like, or at least in the first 20, there was one shot of the exterior of the mansion that was used one time. It looks nothing like what we know, and it was never seen again after that. So right. I kind of chalk it up to, you know, just the growing pains of getting the series started, not really knowing what to do with it. But this is obviously the definitive look of the mansion that has been used ever since. You know, obviously headquarters have changed and they're no longer in the mansion. But as far as what the mansion looked like, this was it. And this was the established look. Mm-hmm. I find that interesting that it took them that long. It took them to 1978.
Yeah,
for them to just show us what the Avengers headquarters looks like. It seems like something that would have been done early on, but it wasn't. Yeah.
Leave it to George, though, you know?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and it was worth the wait.
Sure. Yeah, it's really neat. It's got lots of different things all going on architecturally. So that's pretty much – 167 also has a battle with a porcupine, but that really is just an excuse to have the Wasp and Yellow Jacket and Karina and Michael all in the same room briefly so that Karina could meet Michael. It's just kind of funny to see them fighting the porcupine, though. Gotta love the porcupine.
Yeah, and just the fact that this is a crowded book full of the Guardians of the Galaxy on top of all the other Avengers, and it's all drawn by George Perez, I mean, you get a very satisfying – it's a very satisfying issue, you know. I mean, we're all – this is our like you and I, as readers, this was our introduction to the Guardians ever, and it was just phew, you know, blew me away. It was awesome.
Yeah, because they don't really get to do anything power-wise much. And some of it happens off-screen. Like Martin X does some kind of an energy blast, but that's off-panel. You just see the explosion. You don't see him actually do it. And you never see Yondu shoot an arrow. You never see Nikki actually shoot somebody. She shoots at the Beast and misses a couple of times. You see Charlie grab the Beast and hold him up, but you never see him get to punch anything or, you know, be like the Hulk. I had no idea what Vance Astro's powers were because he never does anything but just sit on the spaceship. And Starhawk we see a little bit of. So you get just enough of a taste of these exotic-looking superheroes to be like, oh, the Guardians of the Galaxy, they seem kind of neat, but on the other hand, I still have no idea about them because this story moves along at such a clip that you never really get much of a sense of who they are or what they really do.
Yep, you're right. Yeah. That's true.
So 168 is really just a continuation of that, where it's the same stuff going on. Two main things happen in 168. One is the introduction of Gyrick, who's like, you know, walked into the mansion when all the security was down, and they confront him. And the other thing that happens is the battle you already talked about of Starhawk versus Korvac. So it's called First Blood, and so that's 167 and 168. Now we got—I got to mention 169. 169 is a fill-in issue because the Korvac saga was taking so much effort and work and stuff to get done that two issues into it, they're already behind, which is not surprising with some of the talent involved, which will not be named. And so they give us this god-awful Three Dooms for Tomorrow or whatever it's called, where, what's his name, Jason Beer or something like that has three bombs in his heart or something. The only reason I mention that is he does pop up again much later when they're in the Avengers basement and find like where they've stashed all the old stuff from the old cases, and one of them is Jason Beer in a freezer, you know.
Oh my goodness, I didn't realize that. That's actually kind of cool. Well, you know, this is what's called an inventory issue, and what that means it's a concept, I guess, that's died away now because of the distribution channels have changed. But again, this was during a time when there was no direct market. There was only the newsstand. And so it was absolutely imperative. It was more important to have any issue by anybody come out on time than it was to wait and make sure that you told an uninterrupted story with a consistent art team. So, which is what we do today. So if the creative team on the book has fallen behind, the editor still had to get a book out because they were going to lose newsstand real estate to their competitors if they didn't. And so to solve this, they, you know, kept inventory stories, you know, self-contained stories that had been commissioned well in advance, were already finished, pages sitting in the editor's drawer somewhere, and could just be pulled out and plugged into the schedule whenever possible. So because it was all about the 100% reliance on the newsstand distribution at the time that that created this this need to do this, and it's why we end up with issues like this that really have nothing to do with the issues around it. Yeah, you can read it. Yeah, you might like it. But when you're reading the Korvac saga, you don't want to stop, read something else that's totally unrelated and it's totally inconsequential. Yeah. By design, it's completely self-contained.
Yeah,
and it's by a different writer and a different artist, and you're like, well, why am I wasting my time?
Yeah. And it's funny is that, you know, who's doing the art on the Avengers at this time, the greatest Avengers artist ever, but that was an issue he had. And, you know, the other book that had fill-in issues during this time was Fantastic Four, and I won't point out who the artist was on Fantastic Four during that time, too, because I remember getting those issues and going, wait a minute, what happened to the story that was going on?
Yeah.
By the way, let me go ahead and mention this now. I'll try to mention it again at the end, but in case I forget, because one of our listeners pointed out after we talked about the first run of issues that it would be nice if we told them where to get these. And I'll say this, there have been at least two or three collections of the Korvac saga that have come out over the years. Because remember, these came out, 38 years ago, believe it or not? It's hard to imagine. Uh-huh. Hard to imagine. It seems like 38 days ago to me. But there are several trade paperbacks. It'll just say the Korvac saga. Amazon has at least two of them, if not all of them. The one thing I'll point out is, if you get the original issues, and then if you get the collection, at least I think all but one, if not all, of the trade paperback collections, contain several extra pages, just like two or three extra pages that were done by Shooter and either Perez or Wenzel later on, that try to give like an epilogue to the story.
Yeah, you know, we should have researched that and refreshed my memory on that. Those were pages that I think were commissioned much later. Shooter might not have anything to do with it. I think they were commissioned like in the early 90s when they first collected the Korvac saga. Because of the abrupt ending to this story that we can touch on when we get to those issues, I guess the collections editor at the time decided they needed a little bit of extra epilogue add to it. And if I'm getting this right, later collections of this saga dropped those extra pages. These pages weren't vintage. They weren't done in 1978 and left out for some reason.
And they have a different editorial slant to them. They fundamentally change what you're supposed to take away from the story.
Yeah, so I don't think it was Shooter.
So it's very controversial. I agree with you. I haven't read those in a while. I read them years ago.
Yeah, it might have been Grunewald. I don't know. I probably shouldn't say that without knowing, but maybe our readers can find out and comment for us.
We'll revisit that in more detail at the end in a few minutes. But, yeah, you can get them. One other thing, though, I think the most recent trade paperback collection actually also includes the Thor annual before this. Which is kind of a neat bonus, because then you get the thing that sets up Korvac that they talk about in flashback in the rest of the story. So that's kind of neat, too. So like, the most recent one was kind of a deluxe edition where you got Thor, you got the whole Korvac thing, and then you got the last few pages, too. But we'll talk about that again at the end. So that was 169. 170 and 171, again, this is the Ultron. This is the bookend two issues to Bride of Ultron from 161, 162. And we already talked about it a little bit, but it involves Jocasta, the electronic woman that Ultron had created to put Jan's spirit into so she could be his bride. She was sort of catatonic, right? She'd never been really activated. And she wakes up spontaneously when these two very amusing moving guys, right? There's two moving men, Meyer and something, and they're moving her around, and she wakes up, and they run screaming out of there. And the Avengers are trying to stop her when I believe Iron Man and Cap show up, who have made up now. And they're like, no, let her go, because they want to track her and find Ultron. It's a great cliffhanger there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then 171 is nothing but the Avengers and Ms. Marvel versus Ultron. And you get the final slap down, drag out fight that we were wanting back in 162. You get the ultimate termination of Ultron in that issue. So what do you make of those two?
Well, I mean, to me, they just part and parcel with the Bride of Ultron issues that were done, you know, in the 160s. It's the conclusion to it. You got to have it. It's curious to me that so many issues went by in between. I wonder if Shooter always had this in mind and just couldn't get to it because he had so many other things he wanted to do, or did it occur to him, hey, you know what? There's more to tell here. Let me fit this in right. And I just wonder when the idea came. What was the reasoning behind having to wait so long for this? Because it came as kind of a surprise. The Ultron story is a year old. That was in the rearview mirror. We were going forward with this other stuff, and then
even though we knew he was still out there, we kind of had put him aside. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We weren't thinking about him, you know. And then in the middle of everything else, this drops, which is very cool and very, you know, like I say, very worthy, but just kind of a curiosity as far as the timing of when these issues came out.
But you know what, though? If you put the fill-in issues aside, there had only been, if you take those out of the equation, there had only been five issues between The Bride of Ultron and 170, and three of those were Nefaria, and the other two were setting up Korvac. That was it.
Okay.
So, you know, the fill-in issues make it stretch out to like a year, but it really wasn't all that long in terms of Shooter's actual script. So that's an interesting little, you know, curveball that goes in there, I think. So,
All right.
So we dispose of Ultron, blowing him up, shooting the and by the way, I was going to mention, we were talking about how 171 is so dense. They do the entire battle with Ultron in one issue. Thing about this is kind of blowing my mind this morning when I was reading it, is that the whole scene where they, after the Scarlet Witch cracks open his armor, Thor draws the energy out with his hammer and then shoots it into space and it explodes. In a comic today, that would take four pages.
Oh, yeah.
It takes three panels at the top of a bigger page. It's like the top 2 inches all the way across of a page.
Yes.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes. Yes, it is. And, you know, I let's just say I lament the decompressed pace of today's storytelling.
Yeah.
This is the way I prefer it. And you know, this prime example of why Wanda poses such a threat to Ultron.
Yeah.
And why whenever he pops up, she's the first one he's got to take care of. because we see it happen right here.
Right, because her power is the only one that can get inside his shell by causing probability to change. All the others are attacking him from the outside, but she can cause things inside him to happen without penetrating his armor, because she's got a combination of magic and that mutant probability power. So she is uniquely suited to fight an enemy like that. Hell, they need to point her at Galactus sometime and see what happens.
Yeah.
Suddenly all the planets he ever ate give him a giant case of heartburn and explodes. Well,
this where her defeat of Ultron here may have been a real wake-up call for readers, you know, as far as like, whoa, you know, hey, this character, she's powerful.
That's true. One other thing about the decompressed storytelling you're talking about, I got to thinking about that while you were saying that, and this really hit me hard, okay? It's kind of like today we watch movies and TV on different size screens, from a movie theater size screen all the way down to your telephone, to your cell phone, right? Mm-hmm. So what you do is your brain kind of compensates, and inside your mind you're seeing the story in your brain at the same size no matter how big the medium you're looking at it on is, right? In other words, if you see a movie on a big screen or on a phone, in your brain you're still perceiving the largeness of the story.
Right.
When we were kids and all we had were comics done this way, I think that we would see a little three-panel sequence like this, and we would slowly go over those panels and in our minds blow each one of them up to movie screen size one by one in our head. Today we look at it and we say, wow, those panels are so small and there's so many on a page. But back then we didn't have anything to compare it to. So we just went panel one, okay, look at this like a giant picture. Okay, panel two, and it becomes a giant picture, you know, because when Ultron blows up, if you'd asked me before I reread it, how big is that picture, I'd have said, oh, it's like a splash page.
Right.
No, it's like an inch by an inch.
Yep.
But you know what I mean? In our heads, it's as big as it needs to be.
I do. I think you're right, and I think what you're touching on there is how or why comics are – you know, why I'm going to promote comics as being so important to developing someone's imagination opening worlds up. You know, I think stuff like this makes kids smarter. And, you know, I'm with you on all that. And I see the benefit of it.
Absolutely. So 173 through 177, we kind of put everything else aside now. And in those five issues, it is the Korvac. This is the Korvac saga on pedal to the metal. So 173, this is an odd issue where the cover is about Hawkeye versus Tyrak, the big Atlantean dude or something.
Yeah, that's 172, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, 172 is the Hawkeye and Atlantis issue.
Right, so 172 to 177, right. Right, yeah. And so there's that going on as kind of the A plot, but the important thing, though, is that we're starting to build toward the Collector. And then 173 is where the Avengers are actually starting to disappear at a much faster rate. Iron Man is frantically trying to pull in everybody who's ever been an Avenger, which is a very Kurt-type thing to do later. And as fast as Iron Man can pull in the Black Panther or Hawkeye and the Two-Gun Kid or the Whizzer or, you know, whoever, as fast as he can get them in there, they're Hercules, the Black Widow, you know, as fast as he gets them in the mansion, they disappear, and he's starting to panic a little bit. So
yeah, it's the last panel of issue 172 that it kind of is the big reveal that somebody is actually kidnapping these Avengers and has them under glass, so to speak, in his secret laboratory. You just see a hand in a shadow. You're not quite sure who it
that's,
is.
That's right.
And then 173, you know, becomes overt. But, yeah, and also, you know, I don't know if I'm jumping ahead here, but this idea of disappearing Avengers and being kept and all this stuff totally ties back into Shooter's earlier issues with Nefaria and all that stuff, where Thor is randomly disappearing and popping back in at just the right moment.
Yeah.
What was left as a mystery then is finally explained now as we see that the Collector is behind it all.
And it was brilliant, too, because it let him use Thor when he needed him and not have him around to mess things up when he didn't want him around.
Yeah, and he had a story reason for it that turned out to be a very cool reason and a very cool opponent with the Collector. And so what might have first looked like just a writer's contrivance for his own convenience was actually had a strong plot explanation, which just, you know, fed a different issue. And, you know, just a huge payoff, and just one of those things that makes the shooter run so finally remembered.
And I'm trying to 174 is one of the best loved issues in general from this era. It's part of the Korvac saga, but Korvac only really gets involved because of the motive for why the Collector is collecting the Avengers, and then at the very end to kind of remove the Collector from the board. But this is an issue there where they first bring Dave Winsell in, and Winsell, of course, is going to end up finishing out the series for whatever reason. George doesn't finish it out. I always keep imagining what 177 would have been like, the big finale, if George had drawn it. That's one thing I regret we'll never see. But this is the Bill Mantlow scripted, Dave Winsell penciled, Pablo Marcos inked issue. You're still using Shooter's plot, but Mantlow does a great job of when the Collector has defeated every other Avenger. Hawkeye leads him on a Raiders of the Lost Ark style chase all around the space station until he finally defeats him. And
you have a carny who shoots a bow and arrow going against an elder of the universe. and he's utterly fearless.
Yeah.
And he wins.
Yeah,
I bet you this issue is responsible for creating more Hawkeye fans than any other single issue.
It is the best Hawkeye story ever.
Yeah, it's you gotta love it. You gotta love it. Dave Winsell. No offense, he's not George Perez as skilled as he might be. He's not George Perez. I wish we were looking at George Perez's art here, but this Hawkeye story, this Hawkeye moment, where he goes against the Collector, and. All time, you know, top 10 Avenger moments.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a great, great issue. And so at the end, Korvac realizes down in his living room watching TV in New York at Forest Hills Park or wherever, that he realizes that the Collector's about to reveal his identity. And so he zaps him from the distance and then tells Karina, "You're an orphan," which to me seemed kind of a cruel thing to tack on there. And she's crying her eyes out. I'm like, dude, you don't have to put it that way, do you? That's not very nice.
But what an impressive sense of power. The Collector's hanging around with the Avengers, and out of nowhere, this huge energy blast comes from the blue sky, and the Collector's destroyed. He's gone. Bam.
He's a pile of dust. A pile of dust later to be seen in Contest of Champions number one.
Yeah.
Because this provides the whole motivation for the Contest of Champions, Marvel's first limited series.
By? Who wrote it?
Oh, I don't know. I can't remember.
Bill Mantlow.
Oh, of course. Mantlow can write anything. Mantlow is.
Yeah, and I guess he knew to start with a pile of dust, so there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, if you don't know, in the Contest of Champions, basically the Collector is the Grandmaster's brother, so the Grandmaster plays a game of Contest of Champions, basically, with Death. And if the Grandmaster wins, the idea is that Death will bring the Collector back to life after Korvac has killed him. So it's neat that issue sets up the Contest of Champions. But anyway.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that before. That is a connection. That's cool.
Yeah. So 175 is essentially the core of it is the origin of Korvac. We finally get the story of where he came from and what you were talking about before, that he taps into Galactus's world ship, which I've always wondered, if Galactus had that much power in his world ship, why is Korvac much more powerful than Galactus?
Yeah.
it's like Korvac, and now let me run this by you, because did you ever read the What If issue that came after this, where What If Korvac? I don't remember. It was something like, what if the Avengers had become pawns of Korvac? But that's just how they
pawns
sold
of Korvac.
It.
Yeah, I think that was issue 32. Yeah, I had that issue.
The actual story was, what if Korvac had won, right? I mean, that's what the actual story was. Avengers becoming his pawns are just one small part of it. Right. And in that, the entire premise is that Korvac was able to absorb the power of his enemies and become more powerful each time. But I never got that impression from the original Korvac saga. Did you?
No, I can't say that I did. Yeah, a little fuzzy, little fuzzy plot here as far as he enters Galactus' ship and somehow that gives him power cosmic.
He plugs into the data banks or whatever and is overwhelmed.
And that's enough to get power cosmic. Then why doesn't Galactus have power cosmic?
That's what I'm saying. It's just, it's odd. I mean, because like I say, if you go with what the what if says, then the what if is basically saying Korvac becomes basically a cosmic mutant. And so the reason he becomes more powerful than Galactus is because he develops a particular ability to absorb the power of those he destroys, and so he can keep growing in power where Galactus just is what he is.
Huh. Okay.
You see what I'm saying? So it makes him kind of a cosmic galactic mutant.
Huh.
But that's never in this story. That's more like between the lines in that what if issue. And by the way, I don't know if that what-if issue is available. They need to include that in the trade paperback, too. That would make a complete deluxe set right there.
I remember really enjoying that what-if issue as a kid, but I also have not reread it in probably 30 years like I have read these issues. So I probably should. You're going to make me get out and read it now.
Well, do you want me to spoil kind of what happens in it, or should we?
I read it. I mean, you know, I've read it, so spoil away.
Well, the idea is that Korvac keeps, instead of Karina, which we'll get to in a minute, instead of Karina basically like not betraying him, but not backing him up, and he loses his heart and he's defeated. Instead, she sticks with him, and he kills all the Avengers, brings them all back to life as his honor guard, basically, his pawns. And then he goes out and starts defeating Galactus, defeats the Celestials. And every time he defeats one of these major powers, Odin, you know, Zeus, Mephisto, every time he does it. And by the way, this is kind of the blueprint for where Starling goes with the Infinity Gauntlet and Infinity War. But every time he defeats one of these beings, he gets more and more powerful. And finally, the only ones that are left to oppose him realize that only the Ultimate Nullifier can stop him, but he gets a hold of the Ultimate Nullifier, and he decides that the perfectly ordered universe is one where there's no chaos at all, and so he's as big as the universe. He's like sitting on the Earth like a chair, and like every Starfleet in the universe has come to fight him, and he just clicks the Ultimate Nullifier, and the universe goes away. Because he encompasses... Remember, the Ultimate Nullifier destroys you and whatever you're encompassing with your mind, right? So if you're standing there with Galactus, if you're Reed Richards and you're standing there with Galactus, if you imagine Galactus and click the button, it kills you and Galactus, okay? He is so big at that point that he imagines the entire universe, which is lined up against him now, and he clicks the button and it destroys him and the entire universe. And the ending is the Watcher from our universe with that great line. I mean, it's just a great line where he says, and you see just the skull of death opening up. And the Watcher says, and thus the number of universes in the multiverse will ever be one less than infinite.
Oh.
I love it. I love stuff like that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So...
And as we pick back up here, the 175, I really enjoy, like I was saying earlier, the irony of this big cosmic scale story, and it takes place like in a living room in New Jersey or something. And, you know, so you've got this image here of this cosmic entity, Michael Korvac, the enemy, whoever you want to call him. And he's in shorts. He's in tennis shorts and a golf shirt. That to me, I just absolutely find that hilarious.
And they take the bus to fight him. They take the bus into an upscale neighborhood to fight a guy in shorts and a polo shirt. It is pretty funny. Yeah, they're like, what is the beast says something like, what's the worst enemy here? Crabgrass or something along those lines. You know. So, so 175 and 176 are really just chasing the enemy down, trying to find him. And they finally track enough of them are able to kind of track little traces of energy that he didn't disguise, that they take the bus to his house, and he and Karina are standing there. Now, tell the folks out there that don't know about, because we hinted at the Starhawk reveal a while ago. So how does this play out? I think this is brilliant. I'll let you cover this one.
Oh, goodness. Well, see, this is where they pile up on the bus. All these Avengers pile up on this bus and go out to the suburbs, I guess, or New Jersey, whatever. And with everybody behind him, Iron Man will go up and politely knock on the door, ring the doorbell, whatever. And this guy in his tennis shorts answers, and he's like, "Hey, you know, what did he say? Sorry to bother you, sir, but yeah. We've reason to believe that something in this house poses great peril to the future of mankind."
That's hilarious.
And but while all this is happening, Starhawk, who's in this crowd, who has arrived on the bus, Starhawk had rode the bus.
Yeah,
is staring at Iron Man, right, and wondering what he's looking at. In other words, who's he talking to? Like, because Michael had recreated Starhawk to not have the ability to perceive him in any way. He kind of like, I guess he worded that command a little too broadly.
Yeah,
and extended to the point where Starhawk literally could not see him standing in front of him.
Right,
and he was so, and that was enough to clue Starhawk in that this guy had cosmic power, because I don't see anybody. Who are you talking to? You're acting like a crazy man.
Starhawk says something to the effect of, "What is this? What? Why are you all putting me on?" And they're like, "What's he talking about?" He's like, "All this time you're standing here interacting, have a conversation with, reacting to nothing." He said, "You're all playing a trick on me."
And yeah, no one, like, makes a fool of Starhawk.
Right, and they're like, "Wait, how could he not see?" And then somebody else is like, "Unless somebody didn't want him to see." And then they all kind of look at Michael like, "Oh."
Yeah.
And Michael's like, "Well, the jig's up, you know? I'm busted."
And then they cut to this close-up of, here's this innocent dude in shorts and a golf shirt or whatever, but suddenly their context or their understanding of him has changed, and he suddenly looks very menacing.
Right. He's covered. He's got the yellow and purple kind of energy thing going on that's his signature throughout this series. So that gets us to 177 in the big finale, and I wanted to have a minute here to kind of talk about this, because this issue impacted me tremendously. I remember that I had a hard time getting it, too. It disappeared off the shelves very quickly, and I think maybe my subscription had run out, and I was freaking out, but I was able to find an issue, thankfully. Now, first thing about it, we didn't really drill down too much on the others, but I do want to talk about this in a little more detail. The cover, it's weird. I mean, the cover is the aftermath. It's Donald Blake as a doctor trying to revive all the dead Avengers, and that's all you see. So it's kind of a spoiler of the ending on the cover, which was annoying. It says, "These who lay dying." But
you know what? Also strikes me as I look at this.
Hmm?
I understand, famously, your first and favorite issue. It's 162. You open up to the splash page, and the first thing you see is all the Avengers laying around dead.
Yeah.
And then so it's similar imagery here with the cover to the magazine.
It's kind of the opposite, right? Though 162 has an action cover, and then you open it up, and the Avengers are dead. This one has an everybody lying around dead cover, and you open it up, and the Avengers are about to start this gigantic battle with one of their greatest enemies. It's kind of the opposite of 162.
Yeah.
But that's a great comparison I hadn't thought of. But I think that they had to do it that way because, if you remember, 175 and 176 covers seemed like, oh, here it is. Here's the Avengers versus the enemy, right? It was like a big energy guy versus the Avengers all reacting. 175 right. was like that. 176 was like that. And I think maybe they thought, if we do three covers in a row, people are like, is it ever actually going to be the fight? You know, because you when I bought 175, I'm like, here it is. And you open it up and they don't actually fight him. And you buy 176, here it is. And they never actually fight him. And you get 177, you're kind of like, come on. Are they ever going to fight him? You know?
Yeah. And again, you know, this supposedly big cosmic story is taking place in a living room in the suburbs. Yeah. And George Perez wasn't able to finish the issue. So I think what we're looking at here is maybe all the reasons why, even though this is one of the all-time great, goes in the top 10 list, maybe it doesn't actually go number one on anybody's list.
Yeah. And it's an odd ending, too. It's not a triumphant ending. It's kind of a downer ending in a way. Because the Avengers all get slaughtered. But the name of it is The Hope and the Slaughter. And it starts out with the Avengers all confronting Michael. And he kind of explains that he's been hiding from them. And the Guardians show up. And it's everybody against Korvac. And this is the thing now. The meat of this issue, one by one, or in pairs, or in threes, or whatever, the Avengers attack Korvac and are killed. They're absolutely slaughtered. Now, as a kid, I read this one as it came out,
And I was convinced this was actually happening. So it starts out with a couple of the Guardians of the Galaxy being killed, and then Quicksilver. And I'm thinking, when he kills a couple of the Guardians of the Galaxy, I'm like, okay, well, I don't really know who they are, so I guess they were just here to get killed. Then he kills Quicksilver. I'm like, oh, man, well, Quicksilver was kind of important, but I guess that's the end for him. And then he starts killing more people. I'm like, wait a minute, we're running out of Avengers here, you know? He's blasting Thor, blasting the Vision. I mean, I'm going, whoa, here, hold on a minute.
You know, and this is Dark Phoenix saga, pre-Jean Grey comes back. So, you know, this is before the comics kind of became a joke for a revolving door for death. But it works in this story because, you know, it's self-contained. The reset for that is still in this same issue, in the same story. So
that's right.
He's able to get away with it. But, yeah, as you're reading this, I mean, absolutely. You're a kid in 1978. This is scary stuff.
It was blowing my mind. And you've referred a couple of times when we talked about 162 to when Iron Man was threatening Jocasta and the Panther, Black Panther, wasn't sure that was the right thing to do, right? He had ethical issues with it. That happens again in this story. This time, Iron Man orders the Black Panther to grab Karina and use her as a pawn because she's the weak link, and the Black Panther is like, but that would not be honorable. And I love it. Yellow Jacket shoves past him and grabs Karina because Yellow Jacket's like, oh, that's not – they're going to bother me.
Right? Hey, he says the hell with honor.
Exactly. We got to do what we got to do. And so Yellow Jacket gets killed. And then you get an awesome shot. This is a great shot from Wenzel of Hawkeye and Yondu side by side firing arrows. That's pretty darn cool.
Yes, it is.
Ms. Marvel gets killed. Martin X actually gets blown up into little pieces of glass or crystal or whatever. Mar-Vell gets killed, one after another after another. Who's the guy, though? I don't know if you have it in front of you or whatever, but who's always the Avenger that steps up and punches the main bad guy in the mouth and stands toe-to-toe with him and probably gives him a good lecture, too?
Captain America.
There you go. I love that Cap has walked up and punched Korvac in the face. He's walked up and punched Thanos in the face. Cap will punch you in the face if he feels like it's warranted. And if you don't like it, he'll give you a stern lecture as to why it was necessary.
Yes. Yes. His speech making is one of his superpowers. So.
It is, yes.
Yeah, awesome.
He'll send you a sternly worded letter on stationery a month later, too, when you're in prison. So Wonder Man kind of gets over his fear that he's had all – that's been another sort of neat subplot that's run along through this series going back to 158 is that the revived Wonder Man feels like he's a coward. He's afraid of dying again, but he uses Cap as an example, and he steps up and fights Korvac and then gets killed, of course. But
it's a good payoff to that whole long-running thing. That was a good setup.
He's brave and he does it.
You know, and a good resolution to that. I mean, it's thematically, you know, it's kind of – you know, kind of it ties in well there. So I thought that was a good use of Wonder Man.
Absolutely. And that's a tricky thing, a good use of Wonder Man. You have to be clever as a writer to find a good use of Wonder Man. Absolutely. All through the background now, we've got Moondragon figuring out, because she's so arrogant and everything and aloof, we've got Moondragon figuring out that, at least in her opinion, maybe Korvac's not so bad and the Avengers are actually screwing everything up. Now, see, that's one of the things we got to talk about here is that Shooter in this original story leaves it very open-ended and ambiguous, right? On the one hand, Korvac was a grave threat to reality, and the what-if issue plays on that mindset. And those pages that were added on later that we talked about played on that mindset that Korvac was a grave threat to the entire universe. Moondragon's interpretation, though, is that Korvac is actually more or less a benign being. He's a good guy, and the Avengers are blundering in and ruining everything when they should let well enough alone because maybe the universe would actually be better off under his custodianship than under Eternity's. So what do you think about that? Because Moondragon is convinced. She's in the background. She never says anything. She never tells anybody, right? She just keeps whispering to herself, only I understand, you know, there's nothing to be done. The hope is dead, you know? How do you read that?
I think that is pure Moondragon. I mean, only she would have that type of attitude, that inflated ego, that goddess-like persona that she gives herself, that she knows better than humanity, you know, what's good for them, kind of thing. So she, you know, she's, in my mind, I haven't read a lot of Moondragon stories. What I know from her is basically 70s Avengers.
Yeah.
But she's always kind of skirted the edge of villainy in my mind, because she has very little compunction against just taking over people's minds and getting them to do what she wants them to do. And I can definitely see how she could interpret Korvac's, actions this way and find sympathy in him.
But you disagree with her.
Well, I don't know that I disagree. I think it's a nice touch by Shooter to kind of flip the reader's sympathies. Like, suddenly, you know, there's the reader going, yeah. Oh, wait a minute, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of makes you kind of like pause and rethink kind of those moments where, wait a minute, maybe everything I just read in this whole 10-issue run means something else. And that's good writing. That's to be able to enjoy it at one level, have a late reveal that causes you to re-examine everything and enjoy it at a different level. So, I mean,
and you know what? I think you're absolutely right. I'm going to make another point too that occurs to me, and that is, we've seen so many world conquering villains whose motivation is just that they're world conquering villains. I think it's neat that in this story, where the world conquering villain actually appears to actually be winning and murdering all the heroes, that you have this added twist that maybe he's not even a villain, right? When all the other villains have tried to do what he's doing and failed, he's actually succeeding, and yet he may not even be a villain. That, to me, adds a whole new layer to this mm-hmm. story that wouldn't be the same if it was a Doctor Doom story, you know, or a Red Skull story.
And I really think it's one of those, like, goosebump moments as a reader where that's what elevates this story to one of the all-time greats. Without that, it remains a cool story, but you know, I don't know if it elevates it. I don't know if it would be as well regarded if it wasn't for that. It's an interesting take. And then we have, you know, Blake and not Thor that steps in at the end. This is it. I mean, this is where the next issue has nothing to do with any of this.
Right.
And it's a very sudden end. You're kind of left like hanging, like, I want some sort of denouement, some kind of epilogue, and you never get it. And that's why those extra pages were added years later in the trade paperback, because we get right up to the end,
In fact, we basically get three fill-in issues.
Yeah, so this. So, like, what was your reaction when you read all this? 178 comes out, you run out, and you grab it, and you open it up.
Oh, God, I hated 178 so bad. Yeah, because you're wanting, like, you're thinking the next one is going to be, like, everybody's sitting around the mansion in bandages and on crutches, and they're all reflecting on what they've done, and did we do the right thing? And it's like a lost issue that never existed, that, you know, what...
Yeah.
You could make like a top 10 list of Avengers issues that are missing that never existed, and 177B would be one of them, along with 200, the way it was supposed to be, obviously, which we've talked about on here before.
Well,
there's a great battle sequence here where you get the Vision, Starhawk, Iron Man, and Thor all blasting Korvac at the same time, and that's a pretty serious attack right there. They're like the last four standing.
Yeah.
And as Michael is reeling, he looks to Karina and she doubts. And when that happens, he sort of gives up and he dies. And so then Karina sees him dead and she kind of snaps out of it. And she immediately kills Starhawk, kills Iron Man, kills the Vision, if you can kill the Vision. And you're not Bendis. And finally, all that's left is Thor. And she basically makes Thor kill her because she's killing herself, so that she can die alongside Korvac. And of course we get that great shot where she's falling as she dies, she's falling towards him and their hands just barely don't touch, right? They just miss.
Right, just short.
Mm-hmm. And all that's left is Thor and Moondragon. And Moondragon basically says, "Yeah, we screwed up. We're the bad guys. It's all, you know, we've all messed. We were totally the wrong ones here."
And so you better turn into a doctor and start saving these people, because with his last breath, Korvac restored all of them to life, more or less, right? So Korvac and Karina are dead. The Avengers and the Guardians of the Galaxy live. But Moondragon starts making Thor forget it. Nobody else will know it. And she says, and I'll give you the quote here. She says, "You will recall naught of the terrible deed we have done. You and the others will believe the Avengers have again earned a great triumph, but I will remember forever." Mm-hmm. So she honestly thinks that the Avengers were the bad guys and did the wrong thing. And as a reader, you're kind of left going, well, which is it? Because we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like you say, we look to 178 to answer it, and it's a fill-in issue.
Yeah, we never get an answer.
No.
Yeah, it's again, it's one of those things that elevates the story, but at the same time, you know, it kind of confirmed my opinion of Moondragon. Like, you know, I never considered her a good guy, really.
No. And by the way, you know who her father is, right?
Yes. Yeah, from Titan.
Yeah, Drax the Destroyer.
Yeah, Drax.
From Guardians of the, from the new Guardians of the Galaxy, Drax the Destroyer.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Because it's complicated. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It is complicated. My gosh. Had to read a lot of comics in the 70s to understand that whole business.
Yep.
A lot of Captain Marvels and stuff. But by the way, that's a storyline that's not exactly Avengers, but one day I want to go through on this on our show here. I want to go through that Captain Marvel story involving Isaac and the programming Thanos left behind in him on Titan to try to get revenge, just like Thanos' revenge program in the computer. It is such a great story. It's got Captain Marvel, and it's got Drax the Destroyer when he flew and had energy blasts rather than being a big muscular assassin guy. Totally different character.
Yeah, I think all of those might be collected in the trade paperback Thanos versus the Avengers.
Mm.
I think a lot of that Starlin stuff from the 70s is in there, not just stuff from Avengers books, but like you basically get the Thanos saga as you have to jump from book to book throughout the 70s to follow it. I think it's all in that book.
So it's kind of this was kind of an epilogue story, and this was in the last few issues of Captain Marvel before he got canceled. And it's the whole thing is written by Doug Munch, and the art is by Pat Broderick, and it's fantastic.
Okay.
We'll get to that.
Oh, okay.
But anyway.
Okay.
So there's the Korvac saga, and like we were saying, the issue, the few pages they added on to the trade paperback try to go back and cut against Moondragon's side of the story and act like he really was a villain and they really did do the right thing. I guess just to kind of give some closure and make fans feel a little better about it, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I kind of like the ambiguous ending better.
Yeah,
It's kind of like a director's cut versus a theatrical cut. You got two different endings, and it's just up to you which one you want to go with.
Yep, exactly. But in the end, we're left with Korvac Saga, which is awesome. And, you know, when you're naming top 10 Avenger stories, you know, it belongs right up there with the best of them.
I believe you got to run, yes?
Yeah, I'm out of here. I am on my way to Athens to watch, do my best to get the Bulldogs to earn a victory over your Auburn Tigers, although I'm sure our efforts will be in vain this year.
We'll see. Good luck with that, and by good luck, of course, I mean bad luck. David, we won't keep you any longer. Thanks so much for coming on. This was really fun. We got to walk down memory lane with another great run of Avengers issues. And
my pleasure.
You and I will come back again in a few weeks or so, I guess, to pick up the next whatever we decide will be the next little batch of issues we want to dig into. So,
sounds good to me.
All right. Avengers Assemble, man.
All right. Avengers Assemble. See you later.
See ya. We'll be right back.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.